Millions of people are living better. They are enjoying a healthier lifestyle, learning more about overcoming obstacles and keeping a positive outlook. Now you can be a member of the club. This is the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. Our guests share incredible stories and advice, bring new outlooks on wellness, and show you how to keep moving forward. Now, here is your host, Dr. Joe Casciani.
Well, greetings to everyone joining us for the Living to 100 Club radio show. We're on the Voice America Network. Thank you for being with us today. I'm Joe Casciani, your host. We have a very exciting show in store for us today. Our guest is Dr. Michael Howard, an expert in aging, longevity, and brain behavior relationships. Before giving you a snapshot of his background, I want to tell you a little story I had. I had an opportunity to pick up one of Dr. Howard's books. I was at a CE class, and I saw his book lying there titled Living to be 100. And I bought it, read it, and I was really impressed with his message. So, you know, he outlined the steps needed to living long, healthy lives. I thought really good stuff. I noodled on this for, you know, a few weeks and decided to create a club for anyone who wanted to learn more about successful aging and managing the challenges that we all face. That was 2 years ago, so I'm happy to thank Dr. Howard for the inspiration to start this Living to 100 Club. Now, a brief bio on our guest. Dr. Michael Howard is a clinical neuropsychologist, rehabilitation psychologist, and health psychologist who received his PhD in 1981 from the University of Missouri, Columbia. He's an internationally recognized researcher and speaker on aging and longevity, traumatic brain injury and concussion, dementia, including Alzheimer's disease, stroke, addiction, and rehabilitation. During his 30-year career, Dr. Howard has had appointments to the psychiatry, neurology, and rehabilitation medicine faculties of three medical schools. He's headed three neuropsychology and behavior medicine departments and directed treatment programs for adults and adolescents with brain injury, dementia, addiction, psychiatric disorders, chronic pain, and other disabilities. He's lectured nationally and abroad for many years, and his current major interests are in aging and longevity, disease prevention, physical and mental fitness, mental disorders, sleep and sleep disorders, and stress management. As I mentioned, Dr. Howard is the author of the book Living to be 100. He currently resides in Texas and is a consultant, lecturer, author, and researcher for the Academy of Biotechnology, Institute for Natural Resources, and Biomed General Corporation. Welcome, Dr. Howard. Thank you very much for being with us today. We're happy to talk. We're happy to talk about these steps and learn more from you about what we can do to ensure longevity, or at least increase the odds. We may not be able to ensure it. We can increase the odds.
More like it.
Yeah. So let's just start in general. What's the bigger threat, age or age-related disease?
Well, we don't really die of aging. The vast majority of people die long before they really could live the length of their lives because they've contracted age-related diseases, which are largely chronic conditions caused by our own behavior.
Okay, so it's not the aging process itself, it's that we can't dodge the many chronic conditions that often come at this age.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Now, age is a risk factor for nearly all these things. As I tell people, kind of starting out presentations on this, the secret to living a long, healthy, and happy life is don't die. Because the very same lifestyle factors that tend to be strong predictors of the people who have the longest, healthiest, happiest lives are the very same lifestyle factors that allow us largely to delay the onset of the major chronic illnesses that disable and kill us in old age. And it really gets down to the behaviors that, number one, allow us to live a long time, but do that, number two, because they're lowering the risk that you'll get the top 10 causes of death, which kill nearly 4 out of 5 Americans. Interesting study that was done back in 2016. It's in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society. They looked at a couple of thousand centenarians, these 100-year-old people, and they looked at the near folks, other people aged 58 to 95, and they looked at the major differences they can find in the people that had these longest functional life expectancy. About half of all the centenarians can still live independently. They're still pretty much able, don't have no dementia, they're able to take care of themselves and all that. And it turned out the single biggest factor that came out was they had a pattern of the delayed onset of the basically fatal illnesses, illnesses that disable and kill us, called compression of morbidity. That ended up being kind of the key thing. And I think my research over the last 25 years, you know, I got interested in aging, well, let's face it, because I got old. I got interested in it. And my research pretty much says exactly the same thing. The biggest factor in the longest lives is not basically developing the chronic conditions that are going to end up killing us. You avoid dying, you live long.
So the people who are living longer have somehow delayed the onset of these different conditions. So what are the leading causes of premature death? I mean, let's say theoretically people could live well beyond 100 if they weren't afflicted with these conditions. So what are they? What are the leading causes of premature death?
Well, right now, the top 10 cause of death, they just changed a couple of years ago because of the impact of the drug overdoses on life expectancy. When our overall life expectancy went down, actually, slightly, as of about a year ago compared to 3 years ago because of that. But the number one cause of death is basically heart disease. That's been the number one cause of death for a long, long time. And about, you know, close to about a quarter of us are going to die of heart disease, basically, which is basically a heart attack or heart failure, about 24.8% of us. The next leading cause of death is all the cancers added together, and that's about 24% of people are going to die one of the many fatal types of cancers that you can get. The number three cause of death is chronic lower respiratory diseases, COPD and emphysema, things like that. Now, that goes way down to just about 5.5% to 6% of people. The top two causes of death are really the big dogs on the block, no doubt about it. Then come accidents, about 5% of people. That's gone up because of fentanyl and involved in a lot of the opioid overdoses that have skyrocketed in the last 5 years or so. It's now number four, and stroke is now number five. But if you put the two big C's together, cardiovascular disease, basically heart attack and stroke and heart failure, and add cancer, the other big C, 53% of people are going to die of one of those top two causes of death, basically cardiovascular disease and cancer. Mm-hmm. Then number six comes, now the federal government will tell you that Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death, but that's not accurate. People don't die of Alzheimer's disease. You die of complications of Alzheimer's disease, like things like nosocomial pneumonias you pick up in facilities, microaspiration pneumonias, you'll die of that, or heart attack or stroke or, you know, septic shock and things like that. But that's number six. Then comes diabetes, largely type 2 diabetes. Then comes kidney disease. And then the last two, number nine, is basically pneumonia and flu. And then number 10 is suicide. And that's your top 10 cause of death. And when you look at those, the thing to pay attention to is how much of those top 10 causes of death are genetic and how much of them are due to our behavioral lifestyle habits. And the vast variance of all those, getting all those conditions, are basically our own unhealthy behaviors and behavioral habits that lead to those chronic illnesses that we start to develop usually in midlife, and then they manifest themselves in older years. And if you can delay, if you can avoid them, that can happen too. If you can survive them once you get them, and, you know, there are centenarians taking metformin out there for their diabetes and taking blood pressure meds and all that, if you can survive them. But the main thing is, can you delay the onset of those conditions? And that largely happens because of our own health behavioral habits.
Mm. So the genetic predisposition for any of these conditions is really a secondary consideration. It's the lifestyle the behavioral choices that we make. I mean, I've heard, and I know we talked about this earlier, that National Institute of Health has said that about 25% of the deaths are due to genetics and 75% are due to lifestyle factor, or not deaths, but let's say longevity. So 75% is due to lifestyle factors, and the other quarter is due to the genetic loading. And as you said, we don't really have good solid proof of that, but do you agree in general that's the proportion?
I think I agree because of the other point that we made, and I've read that research and where they come, those estimates and all that. Centenarian wouldn't be 100 years old. We think it's more close to 30%, 25% typically is the number you come up with of how much of aging is genetic. It's intrinsically built into our genes, but aging itself is an extrinsic process that happens by our interactions with the environment. And it alters how those genes get expressed so significantly. And if you look at the top 10 causes of death that are going to kill basically 4 out of 5 of us, you'll find that overall, about 75% of the risk to get those top 10 causes of death is our behavior, while more 25 to 30% or so is genetic. Those diseases are largely brought upon us by our own behavior, not some genetic anomaly that tends to hit us. So since living long is avoiding dying, even though it's much more difficult to calculate the genetic risk involved in longevity, it's a lot less of a problem to calculate the genetic risk involved in those top 10 causes of death. And they tend to be mostly due to our own behavioral health habits.
Hmm. So we can overcome the genetic predisposition. Like, for example, the person who says, well, my parents both died in their 70s. I don't see any reason to try to change that. I'm not going to outlive their, the time that they lived. And, I might as well continue with my bad diet and smoking and all of that. So what's the point? I know it's my days are number two, just like my parents. So that's a fallacy to have that kind of belief and kind of limitation. And
well,
would you agree?
Form their beliefs, core beliefs, for all kind of reasons, and we can justify our core beliefs in all sorts of ways. I've heard the same thing hundreds and hundreds of times, as I'm sure that you have. The point being is, even if the parents died young, chances are a lot of why they died young had a whole lot more to do with the environment they lived in and their behavioral choices in that environment than it did their genetic code. We find that to be the cases in most of the cases that we look at. Mm. Now, on the other hand, some of it can be due to, as I say, 25 to 30% of the risk being genetic is still a pretty good chunk of the risk. So no doubt genes can play a role. We've got very good data that tells us that siblings of people that'd be 100 years old and twins that want to be 100 years old are markedly more likely to get to 100 years old than people that didn't have a family that lived that long. But there's also ample evidence of people that make it to 100 years old, are healthy, happy, no dementia, functioning well, when their parents died in their 60s and 70s.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because the parents that died in their 60s or 70s, they probably made the same poor lifestyle choices. And had they not made those same choices, they could have lived much longer as well. So it's not inevitable. I mean, certainly, as we said, we can still make those changes for ourselves, but our parents could have made the same changes, right?
And we have to remember that these long lives that we have right now is a very recent phenomenon. I mean, we're living twice as long as we did, frankly, in the Civil War in this country. We're living back in 1900, the average life expectancy was 47 years. So when you look at what's happened to help us live this long, it's largely due to human ingenuity and technology a great deal. I often say it's due to the three Asians: medications, vaccinations, and sanitation. That's what's helped us a lot longer, because we have much more the Pure Food and Drug Act back in the 1900s, controlling water the way we do, so you don't have all these things, vaccinations against deadly childhood diseases that brought down life expectancy significantly, and all sorts of advances in medicine in the first half of the 20th century It was, of course, the revolution in treating bacterial illnesses with antibiotics and things like that that extended life expectancy. And since the latter half of the 20th century up to now, it's basically medical advances in treating the chronic illnesses that occur late in life, like heart disease and things like strokes and things like diabetes and so forth, that we deal with better now. So we live a lot longer now than our parents did, because technology has changed. We have more information. We should be living a lot longer, no question about that. But we still have a better chance of living longer now because of these environmental things out there than we did 50 years ago.
Sure. Yeah, so a lot of the risk factors are being reduced or eliminated. So that means the lifestyle choices are even that much more important than they were for our parents or grandparents.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can't rule out that medicine has made the difference here, but there's pretty good data that tells us when it comes to longevity, medical care is only about 10 to 15% of the variance. It really depends much more because, remember, we spend most of our medical dollars in treating illnesses once they've already happened, not in preventing them. So by the time we get these chronic illnesses and we're spending, the people that have good health care will live longer with these chronic illnesses. But it's not the health care that stopped them usually from getting it, those illnesses. That was usually good behavioral habits that did that. Most of our health care is geared towards diagnosing and treating symptomatic diseases that have already happened, not preventing them from happening.
Sure.
So the vast variance involved in living long is not the medical care you get. It is, even though medical insurance and all that stuff's important, no doubt about it, but it really is the behavioral lifestyle habits that we develop and maintain over our lives.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I see it's time to take a short break. When we come back, I'd like to pick up on some of these actual behaviors and some of the healthy-oriented activities that we can do. So it's time to take a short break. By the way, people can call in your questions or send an email to info@living200.club. Dr. Howard would be happy to take your questions. This is Joe Casciani, and my guest is Dr. Michael Howard. You're listening to the Living to 100 Club on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Stay tuned. We have much more to talk about.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Visit the Living to 100 Club online store. We feature products and wellness information that help maintain healthy lifestyles, promote mental and physical fitness, and allow you to take control of your future. You'll find a wide array of affordable items for staying active, monitoring your health, and adapting to physical changes. Most popular are items for travel, even with your pets, exercise equipment and clothing, heart rate monitors, and personal care items, and our unique Yes, I'm Positive collection. The Living to 100 Club Store offers convenient solutions for active lifestyles. Be sure to spend time on our Learn page for the club's inspiring blog series and add your name to our email list. The Living to 100 Club online store for awareness, convenience, and independence. Find us at living200.club. That's living200.club.
Are you living a healthy and fit lifestyle? It's not just related to your physical well-being. It also means a healthier mind, confidence, improved health, stamina, and fitness. Talking with Tremaine brings it all to you. Host Tremaine Ellis, along with her husband and co-host David Ellis, will offer support, advice, guidance, and motivation to keep you in your best shape, both physically and mentally. Talking with Tremaine can be heard live every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time and 3 Pacific on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Real Life Solutions, Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. To reach the program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to info@livingto100.club. Now, back to this week's show.
Okay, we're back. Thanks to everyone for staying with us. I wanted to pick up where we left off and talk about this one individual, the longest-lived person, Jean-Louis Calment. Dr. Howard, tell us about her.
Well, she was a fascinating gal, really. She was, to give you an idea how long this woman lived, she was born in 1875 when Ulysses S. Grant was president of the United States, and she died in 1997 when Bill Clinton was president of the United States.
Wow.
She lived 122 years, 164 days. She got famous because Paris Match magazine found out she was the oldest. She was 104 or 5 at the time. She was the only living person they could find in France who had ever met Vincent van Gogh, and they were doing some retrospective on him at the Louvre. And they asked her, did she remember him? And she said, oh, yeah. She was a young girl, about 10, 11, 12 years old. He would come into her in the Arles, France, where he painted many of his most famous paintings at. He was in the psychiatric institution there for a year, actually, in Arles. And she said, yes, you remembered him very well. And so the interviewer asked her, what do you remember? She said, well, he was ugly, obnoxious, and he stank. that was her answer. I don't think she was a great interview for the magazine.
Yeah.
She married young to a rich guy. She never had to work, but the woman stayed busy her entire life. She had about 40 hobbies of one kind or another, took up piano, roller skating, cycling, swimming, tennis. She took up fencing at age 85 and rode her bicycle until she was 102, riding back and forth to the store. And when they interviewed her, she would give a different story to every interviewer why she lived so long. She played with people like that. But I'll tell you something interesting about her. She drank a couple glasses of wine a day up until about 4 days before she died. That's why I tell people at the seminars, that's what killed her. She stopped drinking.
She stopped drinking.
Now, she also smoked until age 117. That's a true story. She smoked over 100 years, about a half a pack a day, and ended up being the longest-lived person on the planet, which shows some of the things we know will take years off your life. Some people are able to cope with those things over time, but it's rare. It's a rare thing. She also ate about 2 pounds of dark chocolate a week and put olive oil on every single thing she ever ate. So there's a lot of fascinating things about her. She lived on her own until 114. And then she had a little fall with some surgery, about 110, I think. She had a fall. She had some surgery she had to have, so she let the people take care of her. But she stayed pretty cognitively intact until just before she died at age 122.
Mm-hmm. Do we know much about her diet?
Well, yeah, she did. She mostly did. Now, she ate a lot of garlic and ate a lot of olive oil and vegetables. She had, you know, for everybody listening, and there's just not much doubt about this. Nearly every longevity study on this planet shows that the longest-lived people eat mostly a plant-based diet. Now, it doesn't mean they don't eat red meat every once in a while, but it's every once in a while, or some fish or some poultry or something like that. But largely, they get most of their calories from plants, from fruits and veggies, basically. And that's every single longevity study I've ever been able to find. We'll tell you that. So, like all the rest of them, she had pretty much a plant-based diet, didn't eat a lot of calories per day, had a normal weight most of her life, and probably is absolutely unusual person, because she outlived the nearest person to her, we think, by over 4.5 years. She's by far the longest-lived person, and most longevity experts, and I've met her, read her, you know, emailed a lot of them, believe that our outside life expectancy right now is right at about 120 years. She really is an anomaly, no question about it. Interesting old
girl. Wow. Yeah. So, you know, as we talk about the behaviors, you mentioned the whole notion of avoiding chronic disease, surviving chronic disease, and delaying chronic disease. So can we translate that into behaviors? What kind of things can we adopt today to postpone, to delay, to avoid any of these conditions? Is it mostly diet and exercise, or are there some other specifics that you'd highlight for us?
Well, those are certainly significant. I don't think much doubt about that. Nearly every study you can find out there that I've been able to find, no doubt diet and moderate exercise play a role. When I did my 16 characteristics of centenarians, these 100-year-old people, they nearly all eat somewhat fewer calories than the average person in their culture, often 10 to 15, sometimes 20% fewer calories per day, not hugely less, like the caloric restriction studies you've heard about and all that, but somewhat less calories. They tend to eat mostly a plant-based diet across the board, not a lot of saturated fat. Tend to have more polyunsaturated and monounsaturated fats in the diet. It's not a question so much of high fat or low fat, it's the kinds of fats. They just tend to eat more plant fats than they tend to eat animal fats. That's really a pretty simple part of it. And the exercise is kind of a Goldilocks thing to some degree, like stress. It's kind of a Goldilocks thing, too. They do things like walk and ride bicycles and swim. I've never met one that had a gym membership yet. I've never met a centenarian who's a long-distance runner. There apparently is a Goldilocks thing here. You can exercise too much as well as too little. And, for example, there's pretty good studies that tell us if you run 4 hours to 5 hours a week, that's probably a good health benefit. Get up to 7 to 8 to 9 hours, and you start getting deleterious effects on that. And if you do less than that, of course, that can be a problem too. But most of these folks do kind of moderate things. They work in the garden. They're just busy all the time doing stuff like this. They keep their weight pretty much in the normal range. I've never yet heard about an obese centenarian. It doesn't happen. You pretty much keep your weight, not underweight, but you're not overweight either. It's kind of a Goldilocks thing again. They tend to not have nutritional deficiencies. It means some have to supplement B12, for example. As you get older, a few people can't metabolize that. Other people may have less vitamin D and may have to supplement that to some degree. So they keep their micronutrients up as well as their macronutrients. Very few have smoked. John Calmon was a huge exception there. Very few have smoked for very long. If they did, they tend to quit over time and didn't smoke for that long. Let me get back to alcohol last, because that's the real quandary in all this stuff, is it will moderate light drinking help you live longer? But they do tend to get very regular restful sleep. That's a kind of a key issue. And they tend to have fairly healthy mouths. In other words, they don't tend to have some mild gingivitis going to more severe periodontitis. Now, a number of them have lost a lot of their teeth, but their gums still say fairly healthy. There's a pretty good correlation against significant gum disease and a number of conditions that can shorten life. So because the advances in dentistry in the last 100 years or so, that's made a difference in longevity as well. They tend to keep their brains busy. They constantly learning things. Leonard Poon, that runs the Georgia Centenarian Studies, calls his centenarians people magnets. They're constantly gossiping with people and talking to people and learning new stuff about people and learning new things. They like to keep learning new things over time, and which may help reduce the chance of cognitive decline to some degree. They stay positive in attitude. I interviewed 17 of them. I really couldn't find a pessimist among them, independent living centenarians, which about half of them. They don't tend to have long bouts of anxiety and depression. Some had those periods, but they got over them and they moved on. They are resilient people. They tend to cope with stressors. One of the things to understand about stress is we're not automobiles. We're not a car. The people that don't get much stress at all don't tend to have long life expectancies, and people that have long, high levels of stress don't tend to have long life expectancies. People that have moderate levels of stressors that they cope with and deal with tend to have by far the longest, healthiest lives. Great evidence in that comes from a study right close to you, right there in Southern California, called the Longevity Project, done by Howard Freeman and Leslie Martin. They run it now. Mm-hmm. It showed that Goldilocks sort of a thing, moderate levels of stress that people coped with, had the longest, healthiest lives. These people are very socially connected. They're not socially isolated. There's a kind of serenity about them. Most of them believe their lives have meaning and a purpose to it. And finally, very few have drunk large amounts of alcohol. Now, some people, one or two drinks for a guy, one drink for a woman up to about age 65, a little less after that, have the alcohol seems to have made a difference. In others, not. Let me tell you what I've gotten out of this, and you know, you can look at the research yourself here. Dan Buettner, a guy that wrote The Blue Zones, found his original four areas in the world where people had the longest life expectancies and the highest percentage of centenarians. Well, one of them are in basically in the island of Sardinia by Italy in the Mediterranean, and the average centenarian there has gobbled down a couple of glasses of their local wine pretty much most of their lives, but they don't live any longer or healthier than the Seventh-day Adventists in Loma Linda, California, one of his other blue zones, that don't drink at all.
That don't drink, right.
So what I think this means is, and this is coming from me, it's my interpretation of research and my opinion, and a couple dollars buy a cup of coffee at Starbucks, that's probably all it's worth. But it looks to me like that if you have an unhealthy lifestyle and are overweight, you don't exercise, or things like that, then 1 to 2 drinks of alcohol may help extend life expectancy to some degree, as long as you don't go over that. One drink for a woman probably a day. However, if you have a very healthy lifestyle, whether or not you drink moderately does not, in large groups of people, doesn't seem to influence longevity much at all. But drinking in excess, obviously, it's a problem, yeah.
Yeah, no, I want to get back to that point about the stress and managing stress. It's not that these folks are stress-free. There's always going to be new stressors coming into their lives, but it's a matter of how well they cope with it, right? How they manage it.
Let me tell you, when I talked to the guy that runs the New England, St. Tom Pearls, the guy that runs the New England Centenarian Study, fascinating guy, you ought to get on the show sometime, probably fascinating guy. I believe he told me that in his first cohort of that New England Centenarian Study, 100-year-old people, that he had 3 or 4 Nazi concentration camp survivors in there. Mm. Not that these people haven't seen some horrific bad stuff in life. They've just managed to cope with it and be resilient, deal with it, and move on and not be overwhelmed by it a great deal. They're good stress managers. It's not that they haven't seen stressors in life, but they manage them fairly well and develop skills, because resilient stress management, the research is pretty clear, is a skill. You have to learn it. If you don't learn to manage stressors, it's one of the reasons why a lot of studies are showing college kids now and young people, adolescents, young adults, seem to be less resilient stress managers on using the same test than we saw 40, 50 years ago, because they were raised being protected from failures and protected from having to deal with things in life. So it's a skill. If you don't learn to manage the stressors, then it doesn't become a skill set for you, and you have to practice it and learn it to do it. You got to fail a few times, you know, in order to do this.
Sure, yeah. To get up off the mat after you've been knocked down, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's a good long list. I mean, I like that list, you know, in terms of our prescription from this show. We have a lot of, you know, really important things to do and take on. Let me ask you about diet. And one thing that's been coming up, I've been seeing a lot about it, is the notion of fasting and intermittent fasting. You know, people have said, well, you know, if your body's like a car, you can't run a car 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So let's treat your body in a way that gives it a break. What do you know about intermittent fasting?
Well, the idea of the car thing is pretty ridiculous, first of all. Your body does run 24/7 all the time. Your brain consumes huge amounts of calories at night, too, let alone the daytime. That's kind of a bizarre thing. But when you get around to the fasting thing, our bodies do come designed to fast. Whether you like it or not, our genetic code hasn't changed in the last 80, 90,000 years, probably. We're the same people we were in the Stone Age, and our bodies are designed to help us survive in the environment of the Stone Age. So back then, we didn't get food every day. You're a hunter-gatherer, just like there are many hunter-gatherer cultures left on this in this planet now. The Foray in Papua New Guinea, the Tib in central Nigeria, the Ikung San, you look at the Hadza in northern Tanzania. These people just hunt and gather, and they don't have food every day. So some days they don't eat many calories because there wasn't any food there because they can't really store it. So our bodies come designed for that. And there's some data that supports that if people want to do a 5-2 pattern diet where 5 days a week eat normally and then on the other 2 days you just eat like maybe 200 or 300 calories or nothing or whatever you want to do on those 2 days, that these people tend to have pretty good cardiovascular systems and good blood sugar and all those kind of good things. Mm-hmm. But here's a problem, and I've worked with diet and weight loss and all that so people before. People can't do it is a problem. It isn't the fact that it might not be a healthy pattern. It's just very difficult for people to do. And to just eat that many calories 2 days a week. People will start off doing it, but 6, 8, 10 months later, they've gotten off the wagon. They're pretty much off of it at that time. People just can't sustain it very much. Really is the biggest reason. But yeah,
sure.
There's nothing unhealthy about it in most people. Now, you have certain conditions people have that would basically get in the way of that. But for a normal, healthy person, that's could be a reasonable way because your body does go into various metabolic shunts when you do are low in calories, which we think that's why caloric restriction in animals, we've done a lot of animal studies on this, helps these animals live significantly longer because your body slows down metabolism, slows down the shortening of telomeres at the end of our chromosomes that have a factor in aging too. A lot of anti-aging, if you want to call it that, I don't call it that. A lot of things that slow down metabolism happen when you fast on those days because it's a mild stressor to the body, and the body is basically it's a process called cellular hormesis, where the body is adjusting to that. And when that happens, slowing down metabolism is a huge factor in longevity. Nearly all the creatures that live long have very low metabolism. The creatures that have high metabolisms don't live that long. So anything that slows your metabolism down, not too far, you've got Goldilocks here, and not too far down, but anything that slows your metabolism down has a good chance of helping you live longer.
Yeah, so that's another variable we can throw into the mix, the model of, like our ancestors going without food for a certain period of time when they would go without food, and then they'd go out hunting and gathering and bringing the food back, and they went without food for a day or maybe a couple of days. So we don't have to go to that extreme, obviously. We're a little bit more evolved. But the idea is still the same, that it's okay to reduce the body's metabolism, as you say, for short periods and give your body a break. I like that.
Apparently, that's what the research really suggests pretty strongly, right?
Yeah. Well, I see it's time to take a short break again. Please, if you're interested in calling in with any questions, the number is 866-472-5792. Or again, you can send an email to info@living2100.club. This is Joe Casciani, and my guest is Dr. Michael Howard. You're listening to the Living 2100 Club on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Visit the Living 2100 Club online store. We feature products and wellness information that help maintain healthy lifestyles, promote mental and physical fitness, and allow you to take control of your future. You'll find a wide array of affordable items for staying active, monitoring your health, and adapting to physical changes. Most popular are items for travel, even with your pets, exercise equipment and clothing, heart rate monitors, and personal care items, and our unique Yes, I'm Positive collection. The Living 2100 Club Store offers convenient solutions for active lifestyles. Be sure to spend time on our Learn page for the club's inspiring blog series and add your name to our email list. The Living 2100 Club online store for awareness, convenience, and independence. Find us at living2100.club. That's living2100.club.
Sometimes it just seems that nobody understands. There's one individual who can help. If you're living with somebody who faces challenges such as autism, Asperger's, or other exceptional needs, you'll want to tune into Solutions and Strategies with Dr. Sean. Living the Challenge. Together, we'll uncover a variety of solutions to the challenges faced by individuals, their families, and teachers. Listen live every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern, on Voice America Health and Wellness.
Have you had a chance to check out Voice America's online magazine and blog? If you love our hosts and shows, check out articles that give an even deeper perspective, plus topics about health and fitness, movie reviews, philosophy, business tips and tactics, spirituality, positive thought, current events, and even more about your favorite hosts. It's just a click away at blog.voiceamerica.com. That's blog.voiceamerica.com. The Voice America Press Blog. All access, all the time.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. To reach the program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to info@livingto100.club. Now, back to this week's show.
All right, we're back. Thank you for staying with us. We're talking with Dr. Michael Howard. Michael, we were just going through the list of, well, the lifestyle habits that can add years to our life. And during the break, you mentioned some very good recent research on distilling all of these habits down to some central. I think you call them the fickle fingers of fate, the five fickle fingers of fate. So tell us about that.
And there's a number of studies that have shown it this. When you really look at the behaviors that tend to predict how long, how well, how happy we live, it gets down to five things. You can just look at your five fingers. This is a clue I use with people I've worked with on this. Number one is try to keep your body weight in the healthy, in basically in the normal range. Now, that's not just a body mass index of 18.5 to 25, which is a normal range, but it's also where you're carrying this weight and so forth. But trying to keep your weight in the normal range is a key thing. And, of course, that's a huge issue in this country because now we've reached the 70% level of people being overweight or obese in this country. So the average American's now overweight. So that makes, you know, already that's a challenge, keeping weight in the normal range. The two main things that keep weight in the normal range, the most important one, of course, is diet. And that's consuming a diet that basically is a fairly healthy plant-based diet that's not too high in red meats and saturated and trans fats and high levels of simple sugars and things like high fructose corn syrup and sucrose that we're consuming at huge levels now, keeping the caloric load down what we eat each day and making healthy, those kind of healthy choices. Exercise. Now, the exercise that we talked about, the kind of Goldilocks thing, regular moderate exercise, 30 minutes a day, like walking 100 steps a minute or so, to 45 minutes a day, five, six times a week, that is a significant factor. And how many people exercise that regularly? We think it's only about 12 to 14% of people. And only 30% of people have weights in the normal range. And even less than that, we think less than 7% of people eat really healthy plant-based diets. The fourth thing is drink. If you drink alcohol, drink it moderately or lightly and don't go over three drinks a day. And then, of course, there's a significant percentage of people that don't do that, that binge every once in a while and over drink at the same time, and because that does damage. And then there is the last one, of course, is don't smoke or quit if you do. Now, that doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out these five things. It's really pretty simple stuff. Keep a normal weight, fairly healthy diet, exercise regularly, don't smoke or quit if you do, drink alcohol in moderation if you drink at all. The scary thing is two studies that have looked at this found less than 2% of Americans have all those things in their lifestyle. So even though it's an incredibly simple model to put 16 to 18 healthy years on your life, which is what that tends to do in the average study that's looked at it, 16 to healthy years, less than 2% of Americans do those five things regularly in their lifestyle. Wow. It becomes a choice. And less than 6% do four of them. So our choices are really fairly simple. And you don't have to get too terribly complex or get out there and try to take resveratrol pills or all this sort of stuff out there. It's a lot more simple thing than that. It's simply having your normal weight because your diet and exercise in a healthy range, and don't drink and smoke. Don't drink to excess and don't smoke. It's not that complicated.
Mm.
It's very difficult, obviously, for people to do, or let's face it, more than 2% of people would do it.
Sure. Yeah, even going from 16 to 5, you think that would make it easier, but it's not really. It's the same challenge. Before we get into the next question, we do have a question from one of our listeners. She says, as we age, our sleep cycles change drastically. It seems I can't sleep with my advancing years. Any comments there?
Oh, absolutely. I've worked in a couple sleep clinics. Sleep's one of my favorite research topics. I do a lot of presentations on it. I'm fascinated by sleep. I'm fascinated by a lot of things, but sleep's definitely one of them. No question, aging plays a significant role in sleep. Sleep changes markedly from early infancy through childhood to adolescence to early adulthood to late adulthood. Our sleep cycles and four stages of sleep, called sleep architecture, drastically change. Now, here's the thing. Basically, my advice to everybody on this is, if you're having sleep problems, get on the internet and go to Google and put in sleep hygiene and look up about 15 to 25 lifestyle environmental changes that you can make that may make a significant difference in improving sleep with age. Even though you're going to need a little less sleep probably with age, it may not be good sleep and good regular restful sleep. So a good idea is to look at those sleep hygiene things and look at room temperature, when you go, when you drink, when you smell, all that sort of stuff. There's a lot of factors to it. Now, if that doesn't work, my strong advice to you is don't go to your primary care provider or some generic neurologist. I would go to a sleep disorders specialist or a sleep disorders clinic. Sleep medicine is now a full subspecialty of medicine like neurology and psychiatry and ophthalmology and all that. Get a board-certified person to really look at your sleep and properly diagnose it and then do the proper treatments for it, because there's 78 sleep disorders alone, let alone all sorts of other issues with sleep. It's a complicated deal. So you really want to get the best diagnosis and best treatment. And most people, as you get older, can have better and more restful sleep. Sometimes you can do it with the hygiene. Sometimes you may need some help. But what you're going through with your sleep markedly changing as you age is definitely not unusual. It's going to change in most people anyway. It's a matter of degree and to what exact symptoms that you're having.
Mm, good. Yeah, good advice. So just a follow-up from the same caller, what's your opinion on CBD for sleepless older adults? Seems we see this everywhere without the THC to help insomniacs.
I just finished researching that for 2 months. Cannabidiol, which of course is one of the 113 cannabinoids actually in the cannabis plant, the so-called marijuana or hemp plant. There are two different strains of cannabis sativa, but CBD, cannabidiol, it's only been shown to work in really good randomized double-blind placebo-controlled study. It's only been shown to work with any effectiveness in about four or five different conditions, and sleep isn't one of them. Pain, early childhood seizures, it's even FDA approved. Epidiolex is even approved for that. Sometimes for spasticity and multiple sclerosis, sometimes for nausea connected to chemotherapy, and sometimes for getting the munchies, but that's more THC really than CBD, and helping you have appetites if you have age wasting and things like that. Those are the only five things. Now, that doesn't mean that it may not help with other things. Here's the good thing. There's hardly any evidence that CBD taken a reasonable level hurts anybody. But the issue is, how much does it help? What dosage and all that? That apparently is so variable from person to person. There's just not strong data. Now, the state of Pennsylvania, I think, and possibly even California too, basically okays medical marijuana, which can be high CBD or high THC, the one, but basically okays it for nearly 25 different kinds of health conditions. But the truth is, CBD has only been shown to help probably in about maybe four or five conditions. And even that It's not drastic help. But all that being aside, every person's different. And as long as you're not getting bad side effects from it, you can try it, whether it's edibles or however you can take it in three or four different ways. You can give it a shot and see if it works or not, and it's probably not going to hurt you any, and it may help. That's really all the advice I can give you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so minimum risk with the CBD.
Yep.
That's helpful.
Yeah.
That's helpful. So in the remaining couple of minutes, I saved the best to last. So we have all this evidence about what helps us live longer, what to avoid, good lifestyle practices. How do we change behavior? You know, all the insight, all the evidence, all the warnings on the cigarette packs. How do we change behaviors?
Well, we know that emotions drive behavior towards goals, and we know emotion driving behavior towards a goal is called motivation. How people motivate themselves to make these kind of changes can vary drastically, in my experience, from person to person to person to person. Some people can put together a plan to change because some catastrophic diagnosis has hit them, like they're going to have heart disease or something. Others, it doesn't make a dent in them. It changes their behavior at all. Much of our behavior is driven by overlearned health habits, well, not just health habits, overlearned habits that we've learned in our lives that we do again and again and again and again and again and again. And changing habits is very, very difficult, no question about it. And many people contemplate changing, but they never really make the attempt. And then certain people make the attempt, and it doesn't last. It kind of, you know, zonks out after a while. When it comes to me and working with people, I'll tell you what I've done. That doesn't mean it's the best way to do it. It's just what I do. I think, first of all, you have to set short-term or long-term goals that the person wants and has a motivated reason for doing it. And those goals got to be specific. You got to be able to measure them to get, you know, what they are. The short-term goals got to lead towards the long-term, like weight loss, let's say, towards the long-term. The short-term goal is just to learn 2 to 3 pounds a month, not to learn lose 70 pounds. So you start with that. You reinforce that a great deal. You practice again and again and again and again and again. And oftentimes it's good to have other people doing it in the family or somebody with you so that it's there. And I believe also in having a written plan to do this that you put up of magnets on the refrigerator. So you see it every single day and understand why you're doing it, why you want to do it, what's important to you. Doesn't make a difference if it's important to me. Is it important to you, and why is it important to you to do this? And if you practice those new behaviors enough, they can take the place of those old habits. But believe me, and I'm right there with all of you listening to this, it's a hard thing to do. And I hate to start off telling somebody it's going to be hard before you do it, but I don't believe in lying to people. This isn't easy to do. Changing a lifestyle isn't easy to do. But once you've got a good reason to do it and set the goals and practice, 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 people can change their lives and give themselves many healthier years than they would have had before.
So, a lot more than just hearing from our doctor, hey, you got to lose 20 pounds. That's not going to cut it. And we know that's...
That works for some people. Now,
we don't think that works.
One of the things you learn, as you know, Joe, because we're in the same business, people are different. And sometimes I've worked with people when their doctor told them, if you don't lose 30 pounds, you're going to have a heart attack. Man, these people were motivated like crazy. I've seen other people told the same thing that just breezed right along and never changed anything.
So right. Well, sorry to say we're out of time for today. Thank you very much, Mike, for being on our show. I've enjoyed it. I know our audience welcomes this information and insights. We'd love to have you back. And a word of thanks
to... No problem. Thanks for having me.
Great. We look forward to that. And thanks to all of our listeners for being with us today. Be sure to go to our website, living2100.club, sign up for our email list. Download a copy of my member's handbook, 9 Principles for Maintaining a Positive Frame of Mind. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Casciani, and you've been listening to the Living 200 Club on the Voice America Network. Thanks very much, and hope to see you all next week.
Thank you for being part of the Living 200 Club. We hope you'll join Dr. Joe Casciani again next Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Until next week, stay on the right track to mental and physical fitness.